My name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. Wow. I'm also the director of the New York Intergroup Association. I would like to take this opportunity to welcome you all here this afternoon for coming out on such a hot day and in a city that's so congested with traffic today. New York Intergroup really has a representation in so many areas, and this meeting is really a show of AA in New York, showing how good AA is here in New York City. And I mean, it's not only the five boroughs of Manhattan, Staten Island, Brooklyn, Queens. Did I forget it? in the Bronx. Staten Island, I said Staten Island, didn't I? I'll do it all over again. We have Staten Island, Manhattan, Brooklyn, Bronx, and Queens. But we also have all of, But we also have members of the association from Orange, Rockland, Putnam, Dutchess, Nassau, Suffolk. Hey! So we cover a really large area, and I'm glad to see that we have representation here today from all of the areas. I'm just supposed to open up the meeting, and that's all I'm going to do. I'm not going to stand here and talk for any length of time. I just hope you all have a great time this afternoon, and just leave here feeling wonderful. Now I'd like to introduce and get Bill T. from the Bayside Hills Group, who was the chairman of this meeting and who put this all together. So let's give him a big hand.
Ooh. Hi, my name is Bill. I'm an alcoholic. And thanks to the grace of God, Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor, and you people, I haven't had a drink or a drug since February 22nd, 1986, and that's a miracle for me. I would like you to join me with our preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. All right. Just a couple of housekeeping announcements. We have seating up front here for the hearing impaired. If anyone needs any special assistance, please let us know. We'll be, bend over backwards to help you out. And the meeting is being taped. There will be tapes available in the back of the lobby after the meeting. You can sign up ahead of time. It's a two-tape packet. They make great anniversary gifts. If someone's in the hospital, I use them all the time. Also, last year's meeting would be available. The first meeting wasn't taped, so if you want to start a collection of them, that would be it, too. We're going to have a 10-minute break after the first speaker, and there's restrooms on this floor right outside the door, all the way down the corridor to your right. The largest restrooms are on the second floor, so just go right down the escalators. There's larger restrooms there. And let's see, that's about that. My sponsor said it was going to get crazy. 56 years ago, something transpired. I guess it was something to the extent that Henrietta Siebeling said to Dr. Bob Smith, "This is Bill Wilson. You need him and he needs you." And that started a chain. And here we are today continuing that chain. And we're only as strong as our weakest link in that chain. And Joe started with the boroughs and stuff, and what I'd like to do is, like, I'd like to hear from each borough that's here to celebrate the 56th anniversary of AA. And let's hear it loud and clear. Is Manhattan here? How about Brooklyn? The 52nd state, Staten Island. Queens. There's the Vatican and there's the Bronx. Nassau County, including Long Beach. Suffolk County. Westchester. Rockland. The rest of New York State. Hey! Connecticut. New Jersey. Rhode Island. Where's Rhode Island? Massachusetts. Okay, Pennsylvania. We got Pennsylvania here. Florida. Los Angeles. Cleveland, Ohio. Stamford, Connecticut, we got already. Annapolis, Maryland. Yeah, there he is down front here. Montana? Okay, Hawaii. Island? Norway? And Paris, France. That's it. I would now... Michigan! I would now like to introduce Catherine, and she'll tell us how we recover. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Kathy, and I'm an alcoholic. How we recover. The 12 suggested steps. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I would like to introduce John from the Gotham Group with a word on our serenity and anonymity.
Hi, my name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, and I'm very glad to be here this afternoon. For those of you who would care to join me, I'd like to take this time to recite the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I'd like to share with you from the Big Book a little bit about our tradition of anonymity in Alcoholics Anonymous. There may be some here who are not familiar with our tradition of personal anonymity at the public level. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. Thus, we respectfully ask that no AA speaker, or indeed AA member, be identified by full name or photograph in published or broadcast reports of our meetings. The assurance of anonymity is essential in our effort to help other problem drinkers who may wish to share our recovery program with us. And our tradition of anonymity reminds us that AA principles come before personalities. It gives me very great pleasure at this point in the program to introduce our leader. And to lead this year's big meeting is a woman who is no stranger to this room, having served in many capacities with the Bill W. Dinner, including chairperson one year, a member of the Astoria Group in the great county of Queens. Please help me welcome Corinne Kay.
Thank you, everybody. Well, I am an alcoholic, and my name is Corinne. And boy, is this some kind of celebration. We really got a lot of people here today, and it's this is what it's all about. I'm not going to say this is what I got sober for, because when I got sober, I wouldn't dream of standing up someplace like this and saying I was an alcoholic, you know. I had enough trouble saying it very quietly in the meeting. But it works. The program works. And they say it works if you worked it. And God knows I've worked it. Through thick and thin, through good and bad, since the day I got sober back in August 1966. Ooh. I was 7 years old. You know, it's funny. I live with an active alcoholic, my husband, and he said to me yesterday in one of our many conversations that one can have with an active alcoholic, you know, gee, Corinne, it's too bad you stopped drinking. He says, you were born to be an alcoholic. And I thought for a minute, and I said, yeah, I was born to be an alcoholic. I believe that. But I also believe I was born to be a sober alcoholic. And that's the difference. That is the difference. And it's because of people like you that I'm here. Without you, I'm nothing. The man I'm going to introduce first, Harold, from the Free at Last group in Westchester, isn't that? Yeah. Is a trustee of AA World Service. And he's a man I have known for many, many, many years. We were both considerably younger at the time, but that's what happens. You don't drink, you stay sober, and you get old, you know. That's how you get to be an old-timer. But anyway, let me give you our first speaker, Harold G.
Good Hi, y'all. My name is Harold, and I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of God and the 12-step program, I found an Alcoholics Anonymous. It hadn't been necessary for me to take a drink since February of 1970. For that, I'm deeply grateful. Corinne said we knew each other a long time ago. Actually, she and I served on New York Intergroup back in 1978. I came from, that was the first district committee member, intergroup representative from Staten Island back in 1974. There were only 9 groups in Staten Island then. And she said we were considerably younger in those days. I had considerably more hair in those days. A lot of energy in this room tonight. I can feel it. It's a celebration of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a pleasure to be here. I want to thank Bill for asking me to come here. I've been living down in Maryland the last couple of years doing some work for the government. they haven't been the same since I got down there, but it's a pleasure to be back in New York. It really is, and to be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can't think of any place I'd rather be. I'm one of those members, Corinne mentioned, I'm on the board of trustees at the General Service Office, and I get to travel a great deal. Not too long ago, I was out in Denver, and I met a relative of Jim Thorpe, as a matter of fact, Jim Thorpe, the famous athlete back in the early 30s, and he told me this story, and I've been laughing about it ever since. It doesn't have anything to do with anything, but I like it, and I like the way I tell it, so I'm going to tell it. It seems this politician had to run for re-election, and part of his constituency was out on an Indian reservation. So he goes out on the Indian reservation, and he gathers all the elders together, and he says, I'm going to put a Cadillac in every yard on the reservation. And all the elders stand up, and they say, Goombra, Goombra. And he says, I'm going to put a air condition in every teepee on the reservation. And again, the elders stand up and they say, Goombra, Goombra. And he says, I'm going to put a new pony in the corral for every Indian on the reservation. Just then, an elder in the back stood up and he said, when you go into the corral, be careful you don't step into Goombra. I laughed about that all the way back here. Reminds me of some politicians I know in Washington. Bill talked about the beginnings of Alcoholics Anonymous and the two men that met out in Akron and how we got here and the fact that we've come down that chain to where we are to here this afternoon. And it's a fantastic progression. It's an incredible journey along the way, the kinds of spiritual and humanitarian benefits that Alcoholics Anonymous have brought to the world. It's been called the greatest movement of the 20th century, and I don't think that anyone means that in an elitist sense. We have carried our message to people so many places and so many ways around the world. The alcoholic has always been relegated to the back, always put under a bushel. We've never really been able to look and see alcoholism in its true light until Alcoholics Anonymous came along. As a matter of fact, alcoholism has been in this country since the days of the Pilgrim. As a matter of fact, the reason the Pilgrims got off the Pilgrim Rock, I understand, is that they ran out of booze. And when you run out of booze, you get off wherever you're at. As far back as the Constitution, we knew about alcoholism. A doctor who saw signer of the Declaration of Independence, Benjamin Rush, wrote about alcoholism. And since those days, up until Alcoholics Anonymous, no one had ever wrote it down. Nobody has ever sat down a recipe book of how it works until we came along. There was a great movement back in the middle 1880s, 1840s, a group of people down in Baltimore heard about this movement up in Washington. They went up and they heard about the Washingtonian movement. Washingtonian movement filled stadiums. It swept across the country, and everybody who had a problem with alcoholism were helping. They even had an auxiliary known as the Martha Washington. And again, they didn't write it down. In addition to that, they got involved in politics. They got involved in a civil war. And before you know it, their whole movement collapsed. They forgot their primary purpose. They forgot who they were and where they had come from. Not too long after that, a group of people here in New York, the Marietta Baker and William James, Emmett Fox, they thought they could bring together the religious community and the scientific community. And they began a movement called the Emmanuel Movement. And the spiritual, religious science people came together and they formed clinics. And sure enough, alcoholics began to get saved and began to get help. But before long, the spiritual people began to argue with the religious people, and before you know it, they forgot their primary purpose, and the whole movement collapsed. And again, they never wrote it down. They never had a set of traditions where the first one began with unity, where they could look at each other and say, if we stand together, we can stay together. If we don't, we'll fall. And so they collapsed, and no one has ever heard of the Emmanuel Movement today. Back in the early 1930s, there was a very charismatic minister, Frank Buckman. And Frank Buckman went over to England, and he was very instrumental in many learning institutions, institutions of higher learning like Cambridge and Oxford. And he had four basic principles that he thought that if people could live by these simple principles, their lives could change. Absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness, absolute purity, absolute love. The four absolutes. And Frank Buckman started a movement that was become worldwide. And they got together in Oxford, and they thought that they might be able to go down to South Africa and help clear up some of the racial tensions in South Africa. So they all went down to South Africa. The problem was because they had mixed race people with them, they couldn't all travel together. So they made a deal with the South African government that they would all ride in one car. And the conductors put a sign on the car so he could tell them. And the sign said, the Oxford Group. And the Oxford Group traveled all over South Africa. They didn't solve anything down there, but the name stuck. And they came back to the United States, and the Oxford Movement began to sweep across the country. And all of a sudden, drunks started showing up at the Oxford Movement. And the Oxford Movement began to help people get sober using those same basic principles. And sure enough, not too long after that, a guy had been trying everything to get sober. A guy named Roland came there, had been to see Carl Jung in Europe. Did everything he could possibly, could never get sober, could never find that spiritual magic. And he discovered the Oxford Movement, and he came, and he sure enough, he got sober. Not too long, he discovered, he heard about a friend of his up in Vermont, a guy named Ebby he knew from years ago, and they were about to put Ebby away for life. Ebby had drove his car into a farmer's kitchen one day and got out and asked the farmer's wife for a cup of coffee. He was ready, and Roland went up and he talked to the judges and he took Ebby down to New York, and sure enough, Ebby got sober. And not too long after that, Ebby remembered a guy that he knew, and he heard that he was in New York, and he thought he'd go see him. And he went to see his friend Bill. Bill was in his usual condition over in Brooklyn, had a quart of gin on the table. Ebby walked in, and Bill wasn't all that happy to see Ebby because, as he recalled, Ebby drank a lot, and he only had one bottle of gin. But when Ebby came in and he offered him a drink, Ebby said he wasn't drinking today. And Bill asked him, well, what's the matter? You on a water wagon? Ebby said, no. I met up with a group of people, and I learned some basic lessons from them, some very basic principles from them, and I don't have to drink anymore. Well, Bill didn't really believe him, but he listened politely. And Ebby left. Not too long after that, Bill was on his trip out to Towns Hospital again. And sure enough, he got into Towns Hospital. And he was at that point that we all know about. He was at that point that he describes It's a strange kind of dichotomy for the alcoholic, because we have to sink to the very depths of despair and hopelessness before we can hear the message. And he was at that point. And he heard, remembered what Bill said, and he, and in his anguish and in his pain, he cried out, "If there is a God, will you show yourself?" And you all know this story. So a blinding flash, felt as though he was on a mountaintop with the wind rushing through him. And he said, "This must be the God of our fathers." And Dr. Silkworth came in to talk to him a little while after that, and he talked to the doctor. He said, "Am I going crazy? Is what I said to you make sense?" And Dr. Silkworth wasn't really sure, but he knew there was a change. He knew something had happened. And he said, "Whatever it is, you better hold on to it, because it's so much better than you had." And from that simple beginning, we come down to where we are here today. One alcoholic talking to another. That's the way it started, and that's the way it is today. One alcoholic talking to another. God has chosen to give us that gift. God always chose the least of them to show the others the way. And he chose the alcoholic to show the others the way. He has invested us with this mystical cord of grace that binds us one to another. That says that I can talk to another alcoholic and he can hear what I say. Whereas someone else can talk to the same alcoholic and he can't hear that. And we have that gift that God's laid out for us. And that gift came to me in a place, and some of my good friends from Staten Island are here, came to me down in Staten Island, and I know they know I love Staten Island, but I got to tell you, Staten Island's not the end of the world, but you can see it from there. I came into a group way down Staten Island, the old Snug Harbor group, for those of you who might not have been around in those days. We used to meet up in the Sailor Snug Harbor, the old West Brighton group. And I'll never forget the first time I walked into that meeting. I looked around. It wasn't quite as big as this group here. But the first thing that occurred to me, there wasn't no black people in there. And I said, "I know I don't belong here. This is, you know, Staten Island, they think the John Birch Society are liberals." I walk into to this old Snug Harbor group, and there they are. I walk up to the man who was to become my sponsor, Ellie A. And I talked to Ellie, and Ellie said, he said, "Son, you don't ever have to drink again. You don't ever have to drink again." And I look back at those days, and I look back to where I am today, and I realize that the truth of what he said to me was in those words then. And even though I didn't really understand it, and even though I didn't really believe it, there was a feeling. There was some mystical spiritual grace that entered into me when he began to talk to me. And you all know what I mean. And I believe what he said to me. I like the story my old sponsor Ellie used to talk about. The little Jewish boy came home from the synagogue school one day, and he went up to his father and he said, "Dad, you should have heard the story the rabbi told us today." He said, "You know, the Jews was trying to get out of Egypt, and the Egyptians was chasing them, and they came to the Red Sea. Well, the Jews had an engineer with them, and they built a bridge, and they went over the Red Sea with the Egyptians right after them. And when they got on the other side, the Jews had an engineer with them, and they blew up the bridge with the Egyptians on it." And his father looked down and said, "The rabbi told you that?" Kid said, "No, but if I told you the story the rabbi told me, you'd think I was nuts." It takes time, a little while, for us to really believe. It really does. It seems a lot easier to make it up. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was just the way you were. I grew up on the east side of Manhattan. I was born and raised in Manhattan. I grew up in what was called Spanish Harlem. Spanish Harlem is a place you grow up pretty fast. you might not grow up. You know, by today's standards, I would be considered an entrepreneur. In those days, I was a hustler. I used to find stuff before it officially got lost. If it was small enough, you stole it. If it was too big, you just laid down next to it and claimed it. They used to send social workers in there to study us. One of them asked me one day how far it was to the subway. I told him, I don't know. Nobody ever made it. Now, growing up in those kinds of circumstances, you become familiar with one day at a time, long time ago. I knew that concept long before I came in here, but it was the kind of atmosphere and conditioning and mindset that you have to live if you're going to survive, and it stood me good as an alcoholic. You didn't believe anything. You didn't believe anything or anybody, and the only thing that was real is what you had in your pocket. And that was my attitude, and that was the way I grew up. And it was, I guess, along about the early 1950s when the Korean War broke out, and I was still going to high school, and I knew the minute I got out, they were going to draft me, and I really didn't want to go in the Army. So I joined the National Guard, me and Quail, joined the National Guard. The minute I joined, they federalized it. And my unit went on active duty. I joined the old 369. It's the oldest black organization in the United States. It's right in uptown New York. And that unit has been around since the Spanish-American War. As a matter of fact, they rode up San Juan Hill with Teddy Roosevelt during the Spanish-American War. And when I joined them, I met guys that had been drinking since they rode up San Juan Hill with Teddy Roosevelt. And they had been drinking for as long as I was alive. Well, I came out the streets of Harlem. You know, I was drinking bathtub gin when I was 9 years old. I used to hide number slips in my shoe shine box. I mean, they weren't going to show me anything. And so if I could pinpoint any period or any point in my career where I really, really became an active alcoholic, I guess it was during those days. And it was, as things would happen, growing up in Harlem, you learn how to take care of yourself. And I was fast and quick. My hands were fast. And I learned how to box. And I was fighting the amateurs all over the place. And so I had a kind of mindset that said, you take care of yourself. You look out for yourself. You keep people that distance away from you. Nobody ever got close to me. And I think that's typical of the alcoholic. We've described by some people as loners, and we're not. We're not really loners. We are very private people, and we keep our own counsel, and we keep things to ourselves, and that's what I would do. But I didn't realize in that process what was happening is that I built up a wall here in front of me, and the more private I became, the higher that wall got, and people couldn't get into me, but I was on the other side, and I couldn't get out. And that wall became higher and higher and higher, and it became my protection. And I realized I carried that wall around with me everywhere I went. And it affected every aspect of my life. As we got federalized down and went down into Texas with the unit the first time, they sent me down. I just, it's incredible the kinds of bizarre things that happen to alcoholics. And we never realize that there's something wrong with us. I mean, we can get into some of the damnedest things, and somehow we get out and never realize how we got into them in the first place. I got locked wandering up and down the streets of Juarez in Mexico once and breaking rum bottles on the lamppost, which the Mexican police take a very dim view of. And I wound up in a Mexican jail. And I've been in jails all over. But when I was a kid, we used to go to movies, and we'd see Errol Flynn movies where he'd be a pirate in the Spanish dungeons. I used to think that was all make-believe till I got into a Mexican jail. the thing about it is that I had a fight coming up, and my CO was a fight fan, and he came and got me out. Got me out of all the mess. And as I realized, that's what happens to us. We have these bizarre things that happen, and we get over. We constantly seem to get over, and we never look back to see how we got into them in the first place. Other people can see us very clearly. Other people can look right at us, and they can see exactly who we are. I once got asked to leave a jail. Now, true. They once asked me to leave a little town upstate New York. I was sitting on the curb, sucking out of a wine bottle. Cop pulled up and said, "Get in." And I got in, drove me to their jail, got out, put me into their, they had just built this brand new jail, put me in a cell, and I lit a cigarette and I laid down. Cigarette caught on fire and the mattress burned up. And they took me out of that cell, took me next door to the next cell, put me in there, I laid down, lit a cigarette, mattress caught on fire. The exact same thing happened. The guy said, "You have to leave. We don't have no more cells." Now, they drove me out to the edge of town, let me out the car, and I got out and said, I got over again. It never occurred to me how I got into that in the first place. You know, I would be sitting in a bar, and I'd see this suave, debonair guy looking back at me, and my fly'd be open. The things that happen to alcoholics, they happen mostly because we have a disease that says there's nothing wrong with you. There's a disease that says there's nothing wrong with you. It's okay. It's all right. Little guy on his shoulder that says it's all right. There's nothing wrong. So we just continue on our way. It wasn't too long after that, I wound up in down in Huntsville, Alabama. Huntsville, Alabama, the rocket center of the world. I'm probably one of the few people in the United States that knows how to arm a barometric fuse for a hydrogen warhead. And they taught me how to do that. And I often wonder what would happen if I had fell asleep at one of those consoles when I was drunk and hit the wrong button. Nobody would be sitting here today. But they sent me down to Huntsville. And sure enough, like the typical alcoholic that I am, I wound up with an apartment. I was going to school on the post, and I got an apartment in town right next door to a dentist who had his own still. He ran off his own corn liquor. And I remember one time we were, they used to have what was called Poor Richard's Wednesday down in Huntsville. You could go out on the post and they'd give you a steak dinner for a dollar, and I think a shot of booze was about a quarter. So I got pretty well fired up out there, and I never forget, I was on my way back into town, and something told me to go back out on the post. So I did this cool, slick, New York-type U-turn, you know, checked everything around, nothing was there. I made this fantastic U-turn. Now, as near as I could figure out, and I thought about this, they had to be in the trunk of my car. The minute I made the U-turn, there they were, two flashing red lights, two big 6'6" Alabama state troopers. I spent a lot of time in law enforcement most of my adult life. It is not a good idea to argue with state troopers under the best of circumstances. But for me to argue with them in Alabama was insane. Absolutely insane. And I got away. Got away again. They said, "Get this one out of here." You know, I got right in that guy's face. They said, "Get him away," and I got away again. And it was that kind of process. Into difficulties, out of difficulties. Into difficulties, out of difficulties. Never looking at how it occurred. And that's the stock and trade of the alcoholic. We seem to be able to move on through our lives and never look back at the real causes and the real primers. And it's because that cloud, that haze is in front of us, and it's produced by drinking alcohol. And I remember when I came back from Alabama, and I did probably the most typical alcoholic thing that could happen, I got married. And the only reason I got married is because my brother got married. And that is alcoholic thinking. The gang was breaking up, and I didn't want to be out there by myself, so I got married. And as God would have it, I married a beautiful person, and she became my greatest enabler. And I remember many times, and I always wanted to appear to be this pillar of society, this upstanding citizen that people would look up to. And it could never happen. You know, it would never happen because I had no responsibility. I had no sense of responsibility. I really didn't want to be married. I wanted all the trappings of this upstanding person, but I didn't want to do the commitment and make the obligations that I would have to do in order to become one. I really wanted to be out there with the boys. And it's a strange kind of dichotomy because I really loved my family. And I wanted the best for them. By this time, we had two small children. And things should have been going good. It wasn't too long after that I wound up on the New York City Police Department. Things were going even better. I stayed there, and after a while, I got a better job working out of the criminal courts building. And it was a wonderful place. And things should have been happy for me. But I wasn't happy. There was like a hole inside of me. And I continued to drink. And all the things that happened to us began to happen to me. The fears began to happen. I was afraid to open a mailbox. I was afraid when the phone would ring. I was afraid to see letters. They would be sending me these big letters with these letters with red writing on the front of them, pay up or die. I was afraid of everything. And I really couldn't put a handle on it. By this time I was working over the criminal court building, and the effects of alcoholism were slowly beginning to creep into my life because I realized that lots of times I had to do some detailed work in the courts, and I realized if I had a drink in the morning I could feel better and I'd get the day started. And pretty soon, from having a drink in the morning, I just stuck a bottle in my desk drawer. And pretty soon the bottle was up right up on the desk, and it didn't matter because everybody else in the court was drunk too. I don't know if anybody's ever had any occasion to go into any of these courts in New York. But I used to work with a judge. He used to have his own scotch imported from Scotland. And we'd have a first call, and we go out, call the calendar, go back in his chambers, and we knock back a few, go back out and have a second call, go back inside and knock back a few more, come back out and go to lunch. Come back for lunch about 4 o'clock in the afternoon and go home. Now, the prisoners are still downstairs in the pen. We send them back to Rikers Island, and they used to wonder why nobody ever got sentenced in our court. But trouble, as you might imagine, was coming, and it was coming very quickly, and everything was piling up. I owed everybody. I once went to my credit union. I was going to get a loan, and I was going to pay off all the other loans. And they actually gave me the money. Naturally, I stopped and I discussed the whole matter with my financial manager, the bartender. And I didn't pay anything. And it just got worse and worse and worse. And then one day, it came to me. It dawned on me. And if you can do this, you can take this disease to the moon. It occurred to me that it was their fault. It was all their fault. Now, when you can do that, you can really take off. Because I said, now, if I just got away from this, it would be okay. So I walked out. I walked out of my house and my family, and I wound up in one room. And then it was easy. All I had to do was find a drink one day at a time. By this time, I had lost my job in the courts, and I was just wandering around the streets. And I was wandering around the streets and panhandling a few bucks from people I know, and I go back to the room and I drink and get drunk. Pretty soon I couldn't even afford the room, and I wound up out in the street. And there it was simple. Out in the street with the bottle gang, down under the Bayonne Bridge. And that was an interesting phenomenon. Anybody's ever been in, I know nobody knows about that bottle gang in here. We wake up, I used to come to under the railroad trestle like I'd raise up like Lazarus coming out of the dead. Yeah. And I'd stumble up underneath the bridge, and there'd be half a dozen other guys just coming to, And we'd fish around and draw a big circle, and you'd throw all your coins in it, see who could come up, when you come up with the first, enough for that first jug in the morning. Then once you had the money, the real problem started, because you had to figure out who was going to go get it. And then you had to figure out who was going to go watch him. I never forget, though, in that basement, It was a dirt basement, and it had an automatic burner. And I had been in there 2 or 3 days, and I hated the basement, because every time I was hallucinating, and every time the burner would fire, I'd hear Handel's Messiah. I hear the whole hallelujah chorus. I hate the thing today. I'd come to, and I remember it was one of those periods where I wasn't quite drunk, and I wasn't quite sober, and you were in that kind of clarity, that crystal clarity, when you realize that there's something wrong and you can't pinpoint what it is. And I looked around me, and I said, "What are you doing in this basement? Why are you here? I come from a good family. I got a relatively good education. What are you doing in this basement?" And I had no answer. So I did what I always did when I got jammed up. I was going to pray to God. My praying to God was that I was going to make a deal. You do this for me, and I'll do that for you. And nothing happened. At least, I thought nothing happened. I realized today that God was there. God was in that basement. God had been with me every step of the way. God had not left me at all. I had no idea of knowing that or knowing anything about that. But I do know that there is a point somewhere that we all come to, that God will not allow us to go below. There's a line somewhere that we are not allowed to go beneath. In Ecclesiastes, they talk about, for everything there is a purpose, and for every season there is a thing under the heaven. There is a time to live and a time to die. And I believe that we come to that point, all of us, sometime. And some of us die. And some of us come to Alcoholics Anonymous. But whenever we get to that point, we don't drink anymore. And God sees that we're out of our pain. And I didn't understand any of that. I didn't understand that God was with me all the way, that God is the great reality that Bill Wilson talked about. I didn't understand that there is no reality apart from God. There is one mind, a billion faces, one love, common to all men. And if we understand that God can do for us what we can't do for ourselves, and allow him to do that, anything is possible. I had knew nothing of that. I had no idea of any of that. That was in hindsight, and I realized that today. At the time, I knew that I hurt, and not knowing anything about what I wanted to do something about the pain. As it turns out, I was living out in Staten Island at the time, and I was driving dump trucks back and forth out to a landfill at that time. And for some reason, I blacked out one night, and the truck ran off the embankment almost out into the kill. Nothing really serious happened, and the cops came, they got it back up on the road. And they suggested that I go and have an x-ray. And so I did, and I forgot all about it. The next morning, I was sitting around the table in a conference with some of my colleagues, and we had just invested in a bottle of wine. And I got a call that said, "You have to come down to the hospital right away." And I explained to this lady that my money was in this bottle, and I was not about to go anywhere. But she said that you had to come down, and if I didn't, they were going to send somebody out and get me. And so I didn't want to get hassled, and I went down. Turns out, I don't want to make a long story longer, I had tuberculosis. And I had it so seriously, they would not let me come back home. They shipped me out to Seaview Hospital, which was the isolation ward in New York at that time. And I stood out there for the next year and a half. And I think that, and I realize today, again, God moving in my life, not understanding it, because I realize today that was the best thing that ever happened to me. And it may seem strange, getting a serious disease like tuberculosis is a good thing. But for me, it was. Because while I was in the hospital, I had nothing else to do but lay back and check the record. And I realized that every time I got into any kind of serious difficulty, anytime I went to jail or lost a job or got into a fight or anytime anything bad happened to me, I was either drinking or I was drunk. And I think laying in that hospital, the cement block up here lifted and the message went through that there's something wrong with you. And it has to do with alcohol. And I don't know about you, but it just seems to me that there are no coincidences in AA. It's God's way of remaining anonymous, because the supervising nurse on that ward was watching all of my shenanigans this whole year and a half I was in the hospital. And I was getting over in there like I always did. And she was watching me, but I remember the day before I was to have been discharged. And I was sitting on the edge of the bed, and I must have looked pretty sad because she came over and asked me what was wrong. And I think for the first time, or the first instance of grace ever operating in my life, I told her the truth. I told her I was afraid. I was afraid to go back out. I was afraid to go back out into the world where I knew that I'd be right back where I was, like Alice in Wonderland, running twice as fast to stay exactly where I was. And I told her that I was afraid. I didn't want to go back out there. And again, God moving in my life, she asked if I really wanted help. If I really wanted help. And again, the instance of grace operating in my life, I said, yes, I need help. And when I came out, she arranged for me to go to my first AA meeting. And it was just as I described earlier. It was in the old Snark Harbor building. And I walked into that room. And even though it was alien in physical terms, there was a spiritual quality about that room that I can feel to today. I knew that it didn't matter what I said. It didn't matter how it came out. Somebody in there would know what I was talking about. And I got that feeling and that strength. And I met Ellie, and he came up to me, and he said, you don't ever have to drink again. He showed me the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, every need that you have is in this book. Well, my scheme in mind went right to work. Because when I came out of the hospital, everything I owned I carried out of there in a shopping bag, and that had a hole in it. And I figured, if everything I need is in this book, maybe I can figure out how to get a loan out of here. So I went back and I read that book. I read that book from cover to cover. I came back and I said, Ellie, I can't get a loan out of this book. And he said, yes, you can. Everything that you need is in this book. Then we took that miraculous walk that we all know about and we all love. And I began to understand what he meant by the road to recovery and the steps to take us there. Bill Wilson tells us we're going to build an arch. That's what we're going to do. We're going to build an arch with these steps, and when we've completed it, we're going to step through that arch into the sunlight of the Spirit. That's what we're going to do. He tells us that the first step is the cornerstone. The first step is the cornerstone. The second step is the foundation. The third step is the keystone that all the other stones lay against. And as we go from 3 through 12 and put those steps in place, and we build that arch, when we finished, we know happiness, joyousness, and freedom. And we step through that arch into the sunlight of the Spirit. And I don't know, when I first started to do those steps, I didn't want to do them. I don't think anybody looked up on that wall and saw 89 things they wanted to do right away. I know I didn't. I love Ellie. God bless him. He died about 6 years ago, and I miss him terribly. I used to talk to him fairly regular, even when he moved down to Florida. And he was a beautiful man. He used to tell me, he said, three words you never want to hear an alcoholic say is, I've been thinking. He said, whatever comes after that, you know it's going to be abuse. I would remember a couple of times he would let me, I got a car once that couldn't put it in reverse, but it was one of them $100 cars you get in AA. But he would let me take pigeons to meetings from time to time. And he would say, you pick him up here, and you take him over there, and you bring him back here. Try not to confuse him by talking to him. I would go up to him and I'd say, Ellie, when am I going to get a job? He said, you had a job. He said, I don't feel good. He said, this might be as good as you'll ever feel. I say, I'm nervous. He say, hang on. I say, how do you hang on? He say, let go. We started going down that road to our steps. And I remember the one thing I loved about him, that every time I discussed a step with him, he'd always tell me, understand the intent. Understand what this step is telling you. Understand the purpose of it. And we'd come to the fourth step, and he said, you have to clean up. You have to look up on your shelf and take the bad stuff out. He said, change is what this is all about. We have to change. If you don't change, you're going to be the same person that walked in here. And in my case, that was the drunk. We looked at the fifth step. He said, you have to understand the very nature of those things that were wrong with you. I knew I was a liar, a thief. I knew I was dishonest. But I understand that those were my nature. It was my nature to be dishonest. It was my nature to be the thief. I had to look at all of those things. Then we got to the sixth step, and he said, the sixth step is that bridge. That bridge. You want to step across from what you were in the fifth step to what you want to become in the sixth step. He said that in order to do that, you have to be entirely ready to have it done. And I had to stop and think about that because the statute of limitations hadn't run out on some of my stuff. So I had to look at if I wanted to be sure I wanted to talk about some of that. But he explained to me, you don't have anything to do with it. All you have to do is become ready. And if you're ready, if you honestly don't want to be that person anymore, just ask. Just ask. It's a simple prayer. That's how you rid yourself of it. You just simply ask God. It's written down for you. Written in our book. It tells us exactly what to say. Remove every single defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Allow me to go out of here and do your will always. It's there for us, written down. He said, you don't have to do anything. He said, a farmer can't grow anything. He can plant the seeds and water the ground and till the soil. He can set up the conditions where the plants can grow, and God will make the plants grow. A doctor can't heal anybody. He can diagnose the illness. He can prescribe the medicine. He can set up the conditions where the healing can take place, and God will do the healing. He said, we can't remove our defects of character. We can look at them, know what they are. We can set up the conditions where the defects of character can be removed, and then ask God to do it. And God will remove the defects of character. And that has happened in my life. It has happened in my life. He tells us then we must go back and look at the wreckage that we've done. Look at those things that we have hurt other people. And I realize that as we look at those relationships that we needed to repair, there was a process that I was going through. The exercise of making a list and talking to people about the things that I had done was only the process. The value of that process was that the fear of doing it was removed. The fear is the real gift in the eighth and ninth step. We are no longer afraid to look at the things the way they were or the way they have to be. And it tells us that if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we're halfway through. We will know a new freedom and a new happiness. And we will not be afraid of the past or be afraid of the future. And we know that God will do for us what we can't do for ourselves. And that's happening in our lives. In the beginning, the first people who began to look at themselves and exercise those simple principles in their lives didn't realize what was happening to them, but they knew time was building up. Time was moving on. And as time continued to move on, they continued to change. And they realized that there was a spiritual quality here that no one could even discuss or begin to identify because it was so mysterious. We know today that power is the mystical magic that we call our higher power. Our higher power. Bill tells us that there are three things that we need to do to find this power. We have to rid ourselves of all biases, think honestly, and look inside ourselves diligently. And the power will emerge. And the power that emerges is awesome. It is awesome when you think about the change that comes over men and women. I love women when they come to Alcoholics Anonymous and see the change in women. It's so beautiful. Women have to live in this culture where we have that double standard that says men can do anything. We could go out in the street and roll around in the gutter and get dirty and drunk and get up the next day and take a bath and put on a shirt and a tie and go about our business, and nobody thinks about that. If a woman does the same thing, she's marked. She's marked and she's tagged because we don't have any value for women's thoughts. We reject women's values. Our system has always rejected women's values. It seems to me that there's a demon that's on a woman's shoulder since the time she's born and says that you're worthless, that you have no worth, that you have no value. And women hear this all their lives, and they carry that around with them, and that the extra guilt that we put on them through our society, they have to bring to us in Alcoholics Anonymous. Some women once ask, can you kill that demon? And the answer is no, you can't kill the demon, but you can educate him. You can educate him. You can educate the demon when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and we show you that women have worth, that women are beautiful, that they are God's creatures, that they are here for their strength and love, and they belong to all of us. That happens, and you see that glow, and they become whole people, and they change in the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's the spiritual quality that we bring to Alcoholics Anonymous. Each one of us, when we come, it's already here. And what we do is look down inside of us and bring it out. I once knew a guy who told me when he came to Alcoholics Anonymous, he always thought he would find a spiritual experience here. He knew he was a human, but he needed a spiritual experience. What he found when he came to Alcoholics Anonymous, that he already was a spiritual being, that he was having a human experience. And when he discovered that, he could match the two. He could match the two. It's incredible when we think about it. Bill tells us the great reality is deep down within us. We know that the answer to our problems is deep down within us. Isn't it strange that the answer and the problem are in the same place? We have the magic to find it, the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been very, very fortunate since I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I've learned a great deal, and everything that I have learned when someone has held the mirror of truth in front of me. I didn't learn what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous because I have 3 university degrees. I learned what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous by running into a brick wall 14 times before I realized I could go around it. There's a story my old sponsor used to tell. He would say you could tell the difference between the alcoholic and a non-alcoholic. He said that there were 2 doors at the end of a hallway, and over one door there was a sign that said peace and happiness. Inside the other door there was a guy with a baseball bat. Now, the non-alcoholic would come down the hallway, look at the doors, go through the door, and there's the guy with the bat, hit him right in the head. Come out, go down the hallway, go across the hall, go through the door, peace and happiness, and he'd go about his business the rest of his life. Now, the alcoholic will come down the same hallway and there the same 2 doors. He walked through the door, and there's this guy with the bat, hits him right in the head. He turns around, comes down the hallway, turn around, go back up. There's the same 2 doors, goes right through the door where the guy is with the bat, hits him right in the head, turns around, comes back down the hallway, goes up the hallway again, goes right through the same door, gets hit right in the head, comes back down, but this time This time he gets halfway up the hallway, and he looks through the door, and he says to himself, maybe he won't be in there this time. He said, maybe I can get away with it. Now, the alcoholic, he goes through the door, and the guy with the bat is gone. The alcoholic goes looking for him. The spirit of truth is here in Alcoholics Anonymous. The truth will set you free. I heard that very often. The truth will set you free. First, it will piss you off, but it will set you free. So the truth has always been an invaluable tool to me. And I have come to love sobriety and honor it and feel it a privilege to understand that today I'm an alcoholic and I know what that means. I can go anywhere in any group in any arena and know exactly who I am. I can say I'm an alcoholic and I know what that means. It gives me the parameters that I can live by. It tells me what I can do and what I can't do. And I don't mean that in an elitist way, because I believe always God has picked those, the least of them, the least of them. And he picked the alcoholic and gave him the gift to show the others the way. And we've been given that gift free and clear. You know, we are very fortunate. Alcoholics Anonymous is very new. It's only 56 years old. Many of our founders are just recently passed. I knew many of them. I knew many of the people. Some of our people that are here. Jimmy S. who's going to read the traditions, has been here for a long time and have practiced the kinds of awareness and spirituality that uplift the people around him. And those people are very close to us. And it becomes a challenge for each and every one of us to take the message that we've gotten, that we've been given, free and clear. The message that is in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, to take it and pass that through the fabric of our lives and take that message and pass it on. That's the real spiritual wealth. The real spiritual wealth of Alcoholics Anonymous are the people like you who are here today that have the means and the ability to take our message and pass it out. One of the great poets said, whenever any great society has declined and fell, there is always one thing present. They forgot where they came from. They forgot where we came from. There's a star out in the universe. It's called Alpha Centauri. It's about 600 million light years away. And if we took everybody in this room and put them in a rocket ship and shot them out toward that star, it'd take 300 years to get there. And if we didn't tell everybody in that ship from the day one, generation after generation after generation, who they were and where they had come from, by the time they got out to that star, they'd be a bunch of people just floating out in space, not knowing where they had come from or who they were. So the challenge is here for us, and I make that challenge to you. I had a chance to know Lois Wilson very well. She lived not too far from me in Bedford. And I was on the intergroup steering committee back in the 70s, and she was very active then. I got to know and talk to her a great deal. They read the Bill's last message at each one of his anniversaries. And she told me the story behind that. Some Arabs that Bill talked to explained to him that when he say, we salute you and we thank you for your life, it was because Bill had brought them the message. And they owed their life to him. So they saluted Bill and they thanked him for his life. And it's in settings like this with the New York Intergroup, where people like you have come from all over to help celebrate Alcoholics Anonymous, that my life is saved. So the real spirit and the real message for me today is that I salute you and I thank you for my life.